Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in as we continue to rummage through this old monster box of baseball cards from the 1980s. Today, it's all about 1983 Fleer, one of my favorite sets, and quite the interesting player that we've pulled here. Card number 548, Dave Kingman. Yes, Sky King, who had, to say the least, a very eventful career on and off the field. We'll talk about King Kong, Dave Kingman, in just a little bit, the 83 Fleer set as well. But first, a little housekeeping. Just want to let you know that I've decided we'll continue to do this broadcast, or this podcast, I should say, on Tuesdays and Fridays. That's when you'll see it posted on our Twitter feed. And as of now, we're on SoundCloud, although that may change just for space purposes. But Tuesdays and Fridays, I figure those are the best days for me to post them. I'm a director of broadcasting for the NHL's Tampa Bay Lightning. My workday is about to get a whole lot busier as we get into September and October. So I figure twice a week should be able to do that. If I can't do that, then I'll post a message on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, just letting you know when the next podcast is coming up. Now, speaking of Wax and Gum Stains, again, that is our Twitter feed. We've picked up quite a few followers over the last couple of weeks. Thank you so much for joining us and our bi-weekly podcast, or I should say twice-a-week podcast. Anyways, thanks for joining us. And again, if you could just tell your friends you're a fan of collecting, I just ask you, share it with one friend. Just share it with one friend who is a collector, was a collector, just likes the sport of baseball, and we'll continue to grow our audience here and hopefully entertain them every time we do this podcast. Now, speaking of Wax and Gum Stains, I always like to reach out to some of the listeners who have reached out to me with commentary on Twitter. First of all, Rich Frank from the San Diego area, getting all excited about the Gwynn rookie coming up in our conversations. Now, we just entered the 1983 sets. We did Donruss in our last podcast. We got Fleer in this one. Tops will be coming on Friday. Rich, I wish I had Tony Gwynn rookies to share with everybody, but alas, I don't. I do have a lot of his cards from 84, 85, 86, 87, but none from 1983. So, unfortunately, we won't have a detailed description of the Tony Gwynn rookie card, but as you know, the 1983 sets had three dynamic rookie cards in it, one being Gwynn, the others being Ryan Sandberg and Wade Boggs. So, Rich, thank you so much for listening. I also want to comment on something that Scott Harrison tagged me in. This was in, I think, another conversation, but somehow I got roped into it, but that's okay because I like it. Scott attached a picture of a 77 Topps Ron Say card, the old Penguin, the third baseman for the LA Dodgers. And it's a card where Say is following through on a swing, and Scott Harrison says, "Great card, always love 77 action cards." Now, this podcast, as it stands right now, we're not touching on 77 because we're going through this particular box of cards that I've stored up, have had in my possession for 25, 30 years now. They are primarily from 1981 to 89, but I do have quite a few cards from the 60s and 70s. They're in binders. They're just kind of stored away in a closet. And who knows? Maybe as this podcast evolves, we go back in time a little bit further and pull out some of those cards and talk about the players or the card sets themselves. I will say, Scott, I love the 77 set as well for a couple of reasons. One, the set itself is great. The front of the card is nice and clean and simple, and you've got those action shots. Even the pose shots look good. The back of the card has always stuck out as unique to me because where Topps would normally just have a list of the statistics, if you look at the bottom, you'll notice that there's this kind of a fence thing at the bottom. And if you look at the big picture, basically the stats aren't just on a list. It's drawn up to look like it's on a cartoon billboard, which I thought was very unique and original, and something that a lot of people don't even think about when they see 77 Topps. Also, I was born in 1977. I grew up a Toronto Blue Jays fan, so in a sense, the Blue Jays were born in 77, so I've always had a lot of connections to the 77 Topps set. So, Scott, even though we're not talking about that set, thank you so much for sending me that picture of Ron Say in his action card. And last but certainly not least, a gentleman who goes by the name Sleep Frank is a San Diego resident, I believe, and he was taking me to task for my disliking, to put it nicely, of the manager card. This goes back to our podcast of 81 Donruss, even though I've got a few hundred 81 Donruss cards. The one card that I pulled to talk about was Red Schoendienst, the former manager of the St. Louis Cardinals. Now, let me preface this by saying this is nothing against Red Schoendienst, who's been employed with a Major League Baseball team, mostly the Cardinals, since 1946. He's still alive and kicking and working for the Cardinals front office at the age of 93. God bless him. This guy is amazing. And you know what? Every Major League manager, even if he's managed three games, and there are some in Major League history who only had a cup of coffee as a manager in the big leagues, listen, you've managed more games than I have in Major League Baseball, so respect you to making it to that level. But I've never liked opening up a pack of cards and getting the manager card. Now, Frank took me to task. He brought up something that we had another listener bring up before, that as a kid, if you couldn't afford a Hall of Famer player card, sometimes the best way to get his card was the manager card. And I remember what the previous commenter said about that. He actually put together some pictures of cards that he has, 64 tops Yogi Berra, a 74 tops Leo DeRocher, and a 72 tops Ted Williams. And I agree with that point. You know, when it comes to Hall of Fame players who become managers, there's something special about that. Sure, absolutely. If you're going to open up a vintage pack of baseball cards and pull a Leo DeRocher out of there, well, that's very cool, because you're probably not going to be able to afford any kind of playing card from Leo the Lips' days on the field. And the same can be said about players who have become managers who eventually, even as late as the 80s or 90s, became Hall of Fame worthy. Frank Robinson, of course, a notable exception, being the first African-American gentleman to take the manager reins in Cleveland in 1975. Joe Torre, Bobby Cox, Tony La Russa. You know, there are some managers who, over 20, 30 years of experience, became rather notable winning managers. So if I open up that pack of 81 Fleer and I pull out a Joe Torre card or Tony La Russa or Bobby Cox, it's kind of neat to have that. I will give that to you. But I always bring it back to this point. Think of when you're opening the pack. And you know what? Buy a pack today, or buy a few packs today and open them up. When you get the manager card, you kind of go, you know, it's still the manager card. That's what it all comes down to. Instead of getting that big star card or that rookie card or that insert card or that, you know, special gold refractor hieroglyphic hologram card, here I've got Clint Hurdle. Woo! You know, it's just, again, no disrespect to the manager, but when I'm opening a pack of cards, and this goes back to my childhood, the last thing I wanted was the card with the manager. Give me the team photo card. Give me, especially with a vintage pack, give me a checklist that at least has some cash value to it because it's not marked. Keep the manager cards. So, Frank, thank you so much for chiming in on your numerous tweets talking about the entire hobby and some of the other podcasts that we've done. But you can keep your manager cards. I don't want them. Even though there are a few special occasions, like I said, Frank Robinson or Ted Williams or Yogi Berra, I understand there are some Hall of Fame players who became managers. But when I open up a pack of cards, the last thing I want is the manager card. Just give me anything but the manager. And don't forget, the only thing worse than pulling a manager card from a pack of cards is pulling two manager cards from a pack of cards. And that has happened before. And that's driven me crazy. Now, a guy who could drive anybody crazy, managers, pitchers, certainly female reporters later on in his career, Dave Kingman, the subject of today's Wax Ecstatic as we go into the 83 Fleer set. Now, this is one of my favorite sets. And unfortunately, I only have about 30 cards. A lot of the card sets in this box, I've got 200 to 300. 83 Fleer, even though it's one of my favorites, only about 30, and for good reason. Because of Ryan Sandberg and Wade Boggs and Tony Gwynn and Cal Ripken's second year card. it was very hard, especially as a child, to find 83 Fleer packs anywhere and to be able to afford them. In fact, the one pack that I ever bought was a cello pack at a card show in like 1991. And I think it cost me, if I remember correctly, it was like $12. And, you know, think about it. In 1991, I would have been 13, 14 years old. $12 is a lot of money to part with. You know, I didn't make a lot of money mowing the neighbor's yard. So it was very tough to afford those cards in particular. Nowadays, I'm sure if I go shopping around eBay, I can find some packs. And they're still not going to be cheap because of all those big rookie cards. But, you know, I might splurge one day and say, oh, what the hell? Let me get these packs for, you know, $20 or $12 for a wax pack. Doesn't seem so bad. But back in the day, I couldn't afford it, so I didn't have a whole lot of them. But the cards that I did get were very cool cards. And the 83 Fleer set is one of my favorites because it was such a leap forward for Fleer. And it helped the entire baseball card industry in 1983 turn around. I said it during my 1982 podcast that the 82 sets, all three of them, were not that great. And in our previous podcast where we were talking about 83 Donruss, I lamented how even though the 83 Donruss set was not bad, it was not a step up from 82. 82 was a big step up from 81, but it was almost like Donruss got a little too comfortable. They're like, whew, all right, we made something that works. Let's just put it out there again. And they just made a few subtle changes to the 83 set. Not so fast with Fleer. After they made one of the worst, if not the worst, sets of baseball cards in baseball card history in 1982, Fleer bounced back rather nicely with the 83 set. And all you have to do is take a look at the picture of the Dave Kingman card that we have on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. As the front of the card, you've got much of the space devoted to a photograph. The Fleer logo, unlike the Donruss logo, which was very clunky and obtrusive, the Fleer logo is just nice and slender and up in the left-hand corner. Lower left-hand corner, you've got the team logo. Lower right-hand corner, you've got the player's name and position. And then you flip it over on the back, and aha, what do we see here? Innovation. Something that no other baseball card company was doing at that time. It's not the first time it was done, but in 1983, no other baseball card company was doing it. Fleer would put a small black and white photo of the player in the upper right-hand corner. And then you look at how the card was laid out, the statistics, a nice and easy to read list of career stats. And then you got the standard stuff, you know, name, team, position, height, weight, birthplace, all that fun stuff. And 83 Fleer, the back of the card, always reminds me of a national parks sign or brochure, the brown on white job with the text. But it was nice. It was different. As I mentioned, the picture on the back of the card, while not stellar, it was black and white. It was kind of small up in that upper right-hand corner. First time that had been done in a baseball card since 71 Topps did the same thing, although the 71 Topps pictures were much larger. Still black and white, though. But Fleer coming up with some innovation at the time. And it was almost like the people at Fleer had a spy in the Topps factory. Or maybe it was vice versa. Topps had somebody sitting in on the Fleer meetings, and one of the two sides said, do you know what we need to do in 1983? We don't need one picture of a player. We need two. Because as you know, the Topps set would feature two pictures of the player, albeit they were on the front of the card. But Fleer taking a giant leap forward in their design, not just a clean look on the front, almost like a business look. It's just like, okay, we goofed up in 82. Here's something really nice for 83. So a nice, clean, classic look on the front side of the card, on the back side, even though it looks like a brochure that you would pick up at Yosemite National Park. You've got the picture. You've got the easy-to-read stats. Just an all-around great effort and a wonderful rebound from the 1982 set, which was probably the worst baseball card set ever made. Now, I also like the 83 Fleer set because it wasn't just a leap forward from 82, but it was also trend-setting for FLIR. FLIR would have very clean, very business-like cards for much of the 1980s. In fact, I'd say through 87. And I also liked FLIR's cards in 90, 92. They had a pretty sharp look. So this was a trend-setting card for FLIR. They cleaned it up. You know, in the days before Upper Deck, this was about as sharp and as business-like as a baseball card could be. And FLIR, in my opinion, kind of led the way in that thinking and that design throughout much of the 1980s. Topps had some very good cards in the 80s, some very memorable designs. Donruss would finally get their act together, really in 84, and they would produce some nice sets in the 80s. But FLIR, after laying that absolute stinking turd of a set in 1982, bouncing back nicely in 83 and setting the trend throughout the 80s that they were pretty much going to take the lead in nice, clean. And again, business is the word that I think of. And you'll see that when we hit 84 and especially 85, 86, 87, nothing kid-like about these cards, nothing goofy, nothing, out of place. You know, 85 Tops, you know, you had, you know, the team name at an angle. You had, weird colors on the back. You look at Donruss in 86. You had kind of like that Max Headroom background and border. FLIR didn't do that. They were just getting down to baseball, and I think they started that in 1983. Now, Dave Kingman was a guy who could also get down to business and mash the ball, to put it nicely. This was a guy who was your prototypical home run hitter, and we're talking pre-PED days, not up there with Mays and Aaron and Ruth, but this guy could put a hurtin' on a baseball. 16 years in the major leagues, 1,941 games, 442 career home runs. He averaged 37 home runs a season. The problem with Dave Kingman, he also averaged a .236 batting average and 152 strikeouts. So take your favorite big man who either crushed the ball 450 feet or struck out, and that's Dave Kingman. I can think of Cliff Johnson, Cecil Fielder, Rob Deere, Pete Incaviglia, Gorman Thomas, you name it. There's every generation has one or two of those guys who would either crush the ball or he'd wildly swing and miss on three straight pitches. That was Dave Kingman. Very interesting story about his career, as he was not a two-sport athlete. He was a three-sport athlete. Growing up in Illinois, he went to Prospect High School in Mount Prospect, Illinois. He was a star in basketball, football, and baseball. Decided to go the baseball route at the University of Southern California. He was drafted twice and turned down the draft. First drafted by the California Angels back in 1967. Drafted again by the Baltimore Orioles in 1968. Even though the Orioles would have some success later on, it was a good move for Kingman because he would win a national title with USC in 1970. Then he hit the jackpot, getting drafted by the San Francisco Giants, first pick overall in the June secondary draft, and he signed soon thereafter, started his career in San Francisco, and the Giants figured out very quickly that this was your prototypical home run hitter. Yes, he could put a hurting on a baseball, but defensively speaking, he was not that good. Primarily an outfielder in his career, but he also spent time at third and first base. And, of course, the strikeout problem. So he had a very short lifespan in San Francisco. He got purchased by the New York Mets in February of 1975 for a mere $150,000. The Giants had just had enough of him, so they decided to let him walk. And then the 1977 season comes around, and that was interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, June 15th, 77, he was traded by the Mets to San Diego for Paul Seabert and Bobby Valentine. Now, that was part of the Midnight Massacre day for the New York Mets. Mets fans know all about this because June 15th, 1977 wasn't just the day that they moved Dave Kingman. They, of course, moved the legendary Tom Seaver to Cincinnati and also Mike Phillips going to St. Louis. So the Mets blowing things up, Dave Kingman involved in that. Now, his time in San Diego was very short-lived. In fact, less than 3 months later, he was waived by the Padres. The California Angels pick him up, so they finally get Dave Kingman. And then he lasts a grand total of 9 days with the Angels. They traded him to the New York Yankees for Randy Stein and cash. And even though Kingman was part of a Yankee team that would go on to win the World Series in 77, because he was acquired in September, after August 31st, because he was moved around twice, he wasn't eligible for the postseason roster. So technically, he wasn't a world champion. He didn't get a World Series ring. He was signed by the Chicago Cubs in November of 1977 as a free agent, traded back to the Mets in 1981 for Steve Henderson, and would wind up his career with the Oakland A's, signing as a free agent in March of 1984. Now, his last major league experience would be with the A's in 1984, 85, and 86. He was technically property of the San Francisco Giants in 1987, but he did not play in the big leagues. His last game in the major leagues was in October of 1986 with Oakland. Now, getting back to Kingman on the field, even though he was not a good fielder, and even though he was a guy who didn't necessarily get on base that often, in fact, his career on-base percentage was only .302. So like I said, he either crushed the ball or he was heading back to the dugout. This guy did lead the National League in home runs twice. 1979, he hit 48 with the Cubs, and in 1982, he hit 37 with the Mets. He was an All-Star as well. In fact, a three-time All-Star in 76 with the Mets, 79 and 80 with the Cubs. And poor Dave Kingman had the notoriety of being on some pretty bad teams. The Mets teams in the 70s were not good. All of those teams he played with in 77, with exception of the Yankees, were not good, but he wasn't eligible to play in the postseason for the Yankees. The Cubs were not that good in the late 70s. The Mets were not that good in the early 80s. The A's were not that good in the mid 80s. So officially, it's marked down as the only postseason appearance in Dave Kingman's career came in 1971. With the San Francisco Giants. Now, another neat little tidbit to Dave Kingman's career: not once, but twice, he was called to duty to pitch in a mop-up situation with the San Francisco Giants. It happened in 1973. And the interesting thing is that Dave Kingman was originally a pitcher. Back in his days when he was in high school in Illinois, he was a pitcher. The Giants converted him to an outfielder and a corner baseman, if you will, as they used him at first and third. But twice in 1973, he was called to the mound, pitched two innings in two games. Let's see, faced 21 batters, walked six of them, struck out four, however, and he allowed two earned runs in each of those two games. Unfortunately, Kingman's career would come to an end, as I mentioned, in 1987 with the Giants organization, but for a couple of reasons, it pretty much ended in 86. The publicly known reason is Kingman was opposed to women reporters coming into major league locker rooms to do their jobs, so he sent a reporter who worked, I believe, for a San Jose newspaper at the time, he sent her a rat inside a box, a live rat. And the rat had a sign that said, "My name is Susan." That was the reporter's name. So the A's were thoroughly embarrassed. They fined him and basically said, "Don't do anything like that again or else." But also Kingman says that he was one of many players who were victims of collusion. After 1986, only four big-name players were moved from one team to another as free agents. Other big-name players suddenly found the free agent market was dry. They couldn't re-sign anywhere else. Of course, if you know anything about baseball history, you know that the owners of Major League Baseball teams then were found guilty of colluding to keep the free agent market down by basically not talking to free agents. So Kingman thinks that his career was ruined because of that, not necessarily the female reporter incident. Of course, another reason why Dave Kingman may not have latched on anywhere else is because at the age of 37 at the time, yes, he could still hit 30 home runs like he did in Oakland. But again, that .236 career batting average, that .302 career on-base percentage. Unless there was a designated hitter spot somewhere, he probably wasn't going to get any work anyway. So there you go, Dave Kingman, adventurous on the field, off the field, as of last check, and this is a few years ago, living the retired life in Lake Tahoe. And one reason why I love this Kingman card, not only because of the 83 Fleer set, which I already lauded about, but this is a great picture of Dave Kingman because you catch him in a rare moment of levity. It looks like it's in the dugout. And while I love action shots and even some pose shots are pretty interesting from the 83 Fleer set, this one is an extreme close-up. You're practically going up Dave Kingman's nose. And with the Mets in the early to mid-80s, a camera going up the nose was the least of the team's worries. They had lots of stuff going up there. Not saying Dave Kingman did, but certainly some of his soon-to-be superstar teammates did at the time. So a unique picture of Dave Kingman, card number 548 from the 83 Fleer set, our pull for this podcast. Well, that'll wrap up our podcast for this time around. Next time around, the legendary 83 Tops. We'll talk about how that was a nice rebound from 1982, and it also had those legendary rookie cards. If you have any comments about the 83 Fleer set we just talked about or anything else related to baseball cards, card collecting, the sport of baseball, again, follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. I'll be happy to include your comments right here on the program. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Wax Ecstatic.